just when you thought it was safe to take on a little risk. Well, stick around, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 6th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So, you remember back in the financial crisis? And if you don't remember, I'm about to tell you. You remember how we all discovered in a most painful and not good way how interconnected everything was? The housing market went kerflooey, and all of a sudden, everything else kind of went south. Well, fast forward with me now to the European energy market of 2022. I'm not saying this is 2008, but I'm also not saying that, because Bloomberg did some math over the weekend, and it figures there's more than $1.5 trillion tied up in European energy market collateral, both natural gas and electricity. Marketplace's Samantha Fields is on the Unexpected Market Risk Desk today.
The reason utility companies find themselves in this position, aside from the high cost of energy, is because they play the market in order to smooth out fluctuations in energy prices. For instance, they'll bet that the price of energy will go up a certain amount, and if they win the bet, they can use some of those winnings to keep down the price they charge their customers.
They try to protect against the risk to their company's profits.
Morgan Bazilian is a professor of public policy at the Colorado School of Mines.
But when prices go sharply up, they find themselves in loss-making positions. In other words, they find themselves in some trouble with the markets.
And they have to put up more collateral, in some cases so much that they may not be able to do business anymore.
We're in a situation here which is extremely dire.
Matt Smith is at the data and analytics firm Kepler.
You could see widespread utility companies essentially going bankrupt just because they do not have the cash available to run their day-to-day operations.
Governments have been stepping in to backstop them, Smith says, but it's likely that more government support is going to be needed. Meanwhile, the high prices and volatility in the energy markets are already having significant ripple effects in other markets, too. One example?
Something like 70% of fertilizer production is offline in Europe right now because natural gas is just too expensive to make the economics of making fertilizer work.
Jason Bordoff is with Colombia's Center on Global Energy Policy.
That is going to affect agricultural output in developing countries, emerging markets across the world in the coming months, and potentially worsen a food crisis that was already underway because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
Because, he says, energy markets, food markets, and, well, pretty much everything is interconnected. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
That's what I said. It's all interconnected. Wall Street this Tuesday with summertime in the rearview mirror. Not so great. TBH, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's going to be 100 degrees at my house today, but I'll tell you what, I'm a piker compared to Matt Levin. It's going to be 114 in Sacramento, where Matt is. Matt and me and millions of other people, to be clear, are now on day 7, I think. I kind of lost track of a brutal heat wave out here in the American West. And California's independent system operator, basically the agency in charge of most of this state's power grid, is asking us to lay off the AC in the afternoons and evenings so that literally they can keep the lights on. We have been here before, California has, but this time seems different, in part because with the rise of hybrid work, those lights are on at the office and in the living room. Here's Matt.
Steve Malsom works from home full time in Southern California. When his air conditioning broke a few weeks back, he thought about working at a coffee shop instead of sweating out this heat wave in his bedroom.
But then I'd be one of those people that's talking out loud on speakerphone out in public, and nobody wants to be that guy.
The state of California might prefer Malsom were that guy once he gets his AC working again. Severin Borenstein researches energy markets at UC Berkeley.
Remote work is probably making things worse right now. They're still cooling the offices, and yet people are staying home and also air conditioning on these very hot days.
He says for the energy grid, hybrid work is the worst of both worlds, especially if employers don't coordinate which days employees come in. And he worries about the energy impact of that pandemic home renovation craze.
I suspect because people are working from home more, we are seeing more air conditioning being put in.
Remote workers may not be reckless with the AC because they directly bear the cost of running it. But Vijay Modi at Columbia University says how low you set the thermostat really depends on how well off you are.
Those who are doing okay financially are thinking about comfort first.
One energy saving tip for me here in Sacramento, no need to use the oven for dinner. You can just fry an egg on the sidewalk. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
It's not just AC that the Cal ISO, the independent system operator I was mentioning, wants us to cut back on. There are the now standard warnings about turning off all the lights and not using big appliances and, oh, also not charging electric vehicles during those 4 to 9 p.m. peak usage hours. I think I mentioned this the other day, the irony of the climate change-inspired ban on new gas-powered cars in California that's coming in 2035 and a power grid that is clearly not ready for our all-electric future. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Americans drive about 3 trillion miles a year. Right now, about 1% of cars on the road are electric. Move all those miles from gas power to battery?
I mean, it's going to require us to generate more electricity.
How much more is complicated, says Joshua Rhodes at the University of Texas at Austin. Sure, big populous states with lots of cars will need more, but that's just part of the equation. Take his state of Texas, where in hot months, air conditioning is vital.
Texas already uses a lot of electricity. We already have a lot of power plants, and we do have some slack into the systems.
He found Texas would need about 25% more power if all cars were electric. California, on the other hand, would need about 50% more. And that power needs to get to cars, says Michael Haggerty with the Brattle Group.
In terms of transmission lines, distribution systems, and chargers.
His firm estimates the full electricity supply chain will need about $100 billion of investment to meet the demand by 2030. But unlike, say, air conditioners, cars have giant batteries and don't usually need to be charged during peak hours, says Ethan Elkind at UC Berkeley.
Well, a big thing is to really adjust our electricity rates so that we make it very cheap for people to charge their vehicles at off-peak hours.
One way to take some of the strain off the grid when more EVs hit the road. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Let's be clear as we set up this next piece that tax policy and reporting on tax policy can be daunting. It's the very opposite of transparent and easy to understand tax policy is, but both the policy and the reporting on it are critical in no small part because the opacity lends itself to, if not fraud, then certainly unintended consequences. And that gets us to an investigation by Emily Corwin, published by ProPublica, about something called the Work Opportunity Tax Credit. It's been around for decades, that credit has. Nowadays, it's about a $2 billion a year program designed to give businesses tax credits for permanently hiring people primarily from marginalized groups. Here is Emily Corwin.
So we found that the program is not just a boon to large, low-wage employers with high turnover, but more surprisingly, it's a huge boon to the temporary staffing industry, which by definition is not offering permanent employment. And so in our data, you know, nearly 1 in 4 of the certifications for this tax credit is going to temp agencies. If you take Kelly Services, for example, over the last decade, Kelly Services received $164 million in tax credits, which, to put that in context, is half of the company's pre-tax earnings. So it's really a big substantial impact that the program's making.
One of the things that these temp companies say is that, hey, look, temp jobs are, yes, they're temporary, but they are stepping stones to permanent employment. Does that hold up in practice?
Researchers, economists who have actually studied this say, you know, no. I mean, there are times when temp jobs lead to permanent employment. There are instances, but do they routinely lead to permanent employment? The answer is no.
You spend a lot of time on the phone with a lot of people who have been hired into
companies to get this tax credit. Pick your favorite. What's give me a story.
Sure. So, I didn't just spend time on the phone. I actually also drove from Chicago down to Atlanta, and I talked to just tons of people in parking lots outside of temp agencies. And just one thing is that the sheer number of people with felony records working for temp agencies is astonishing. So Demond, the character who I sort of feature in my reporting, is a person who's formerly incarcerated. In his case, he was incarcerated for a long time for violent charges, which he maintains his innocence. When he got out, he had done a ton of work inside to prepare himself for life on the outside. He had gotten multiple associate's degrees. He had gotten multiple certificates in carpentry. He was hoping to get a job with a labor union. And instead, he found he could only get temp work. And like many people in his shoes, he was attracted to temp agencies, quote, temp to hire positions. And he was told, you know, you work 90 days earning, I think it was $14 an hour, and you won't get benefits at first. You know, he just worked so hard. His manager loves him and says, you know, we're gonna definitely bring you on permanently when your time is up. And 90 days are up. He applies for the job. And for the first time, this company, tenant company, runs his background check and discovers that he has this record and says, oh, hold up. No, we don't hire people like you. And he's back to zero. He's unemployed. He's devastated. But the temp agency, you know, not only got to collect a percentage of his wages through their contract with this company, but they also now are eligible for, you know, up to $2,400 in tax credits for having hired a formerly incarcerated person.
I hate to end on a deeply cynical question, but I kind of have to. You spent a very long time reporting this and chewing over what it meant. Did any of it surprise you?
Let me think about that.
Yeah.
I was surprised, honestly. This is even more cynical than your question. I was surprised by how many people accept their fate as temp workers earning less than the people they're working alongside because of their criminal record. And honestly, at times it made me really question what I was doing. Is there anything wrong with this if the people who are involved in it have accepted it so completely? And I had to circle back and be like, yes. But that left me feeling pretty cynical too, to be honest, Kai.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Emily Corman, it's a good piece if, you know, kind of depressing in ProPublica about the work opportunity tax credit and how it's used or perhaps misused in this economy. Emily, thanks a lot.
Hey, thanks, Kai. I mean, is that like too depressing of a note to end on?
Absolutely not. It's what it was. That's why I asked the question. I mean, how do you do this work and not come out of it going, Jesus, you know?
Yeah.
Absolutely right.
Because the truth is, now that I think about it, I was also like deeply inspired by Demond Bush and his resilience. But
fair enough.
I don't know.
Fair enough. Look, these are real reactions. I appreciate you taking the time, Emily.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up,
you could bet on every player's at bat.
The wild world of sports betting. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 173 today, about a 0.5%, 31,145. The NASDAQ gave back 85 points, 0.75%, 11,544. S&P 500 down 16, 0.4%, 39.08. The final tally there. CVS dipped 0.7%. The drugstore operator said it plans to buy in-home healthcare firm Signify Health. That's an $8 billion deal. Signify picked up 0.1%. FedEx down 0.2% on a downgrade from Citi. The bank cited a likely slowing of volume in the months ahead and challenges in the freight industry. Rival UPS slipped less than 0.1% today. Bond prices down. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note up to 3.34%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Europe has been putting on a mostly united front since Russia went to war with Ukraine. But as was perhaps inevitable, the longer the fighting drags on, the more any cracks in the alliance become actual fault lines. To wit, the European Union has decided to make it harder and more expensive for Russian tourists to visit the continent. But some of the bloc's more eastern members say Brussels isn't going far enough, and they want a blanket ban on travel visas for Russian citizens entirely. From the European Desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
At a news conference in the Norwegian capital last month, the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz made clear his opposition to a total ban on Russian visitors to the EU. Yes, he said, we must hit Putin's henchmen hard, but not ordinary Russian citizens.
This is not the war of the Russian people, it is Putin's war, and we have to be very clear on that topic.
But at the same news conference, the Prime Minister of Finland, Sanna Marin, stressed her country's support for a total ban.
I think it's not right that Russian citizens can travel, enter Europe, be tourists, see the sights while Russia is killing people in Ukraine. It's wrong.
Four other EU member states share that view. Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania and Poland all have a land border with Russia and a long troubled history with that dominant neighbour. Estonia's foreign minister Urmas Reinsalu told me in a phone call from his country's capital Tallinn that Russian citizens must bear some responsibility for Putin's war.
Their passivity still legitimizes that war and these atrocities.
And he says ordinary Russians have made the conflict possible.
Their tax money is used now to finance a bombing of schools, hospitals, kindergartens in Ukrainian soil. Citizens of aggressor state, with some clear exceptions, are not welcome in European soil.
In fact, the number of Russian tourists visiting the major holiday destinations of Europe has slumped since the start of the pandemic. The number of EU travel visas they applied for has fallen almost 90%. But with an eye to the future, the countries with major tourist industries oppose the visa ban: France, Portugal, Spain, Italy, and Greece. With ads like this, the Greeks were once luring to their shores more than 500,000 Russian visitors a year. Just before the war in Ukraine, Greece had been expecting 600,000 Russians this year to spend the equivalent of more than $700 million, around 2.25% of Greece's total tourism revenue.
Unfortunately, we lost all this business due to the war between the Russians and the Ukrainians.
Lysandros Silides, head of the Hellenic Association of Tourist and Travel Agencies in Athens. He says after the EU's ban on flights from Russia, there was a flood of cancellations and the expected bookings did not materialize. He opposes a visa ban, not just for business reasons, but because unfettered travel broadens the mind and promotes peace.
Visitors, they are people, and people have the right to move and think and speak freely, friendly, easily.
So would exposure to free Western media and society open Russian eyes and erode support for Putin? Sebastian Stodolak, vice president of the Warsaw Enterprise Institute in Poland, isn't buying it.
Russians have been traveling around the world for the last 8 years since the Crimea annexation, and did they come to their senses? No, obviously not.
The issue of a total visa ban will be discussed at a major EU summit next month. Poland, Finland and the Baltic states say they'll keep pushing for a ban. But Germany and the tourist economies and the Putin-sympathizing Hungary say they'll keep opposing it. Another, albeit small, crack in the EU's fragile united front over the Russian invasion of Ukraine. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The NFL season starts Thursday night. The Super Bowl champion Los Angeles Rams host Buffalo, and you can expect the standard amount of football industry hoopla to accompany the weekend's games. For a lot of people, that hoopla includes fantasy football and maybe, probably, some wagers on the side. It's been 4 years since the Supreme Court did away with a federal ban on sports betting and left it up to states to decide whether they are going to allow it.
As of right now, sports betting is legal in 36 states, and the District of Columbia, Kansas, and Maine joined the list this month. Massachusetts will soon. And as Marketplace's Andy Euler reports, legalized sports betting sets up some competing interests. For states, a whole lot of potential tax revenue. For some bettors, some difficult-to-resist temptation.
If you plan on watching any NFL games this year, get ready to hear a lot of this.
With FanDuel, you can bet $5 and win $280 cash on either team to win the Super Bowl.
Play DraftKings' free fourth quarter prediction challenge. If you finish first, you could win $1 million.
You want to make every game interesting? Step one, open the BetMGM Sportsbook.
Bookmakers are chasing a piece of the estimated $100 billion that Americans wager on the NFL every season.
Americans have always bet on sports. They've just now been able to do it in a regulated market.
Oklahoma State University economist John Holden says that market is only going to keep growing. And most of that growth is going to come from people betting on their phones.
All of the money, relatively speaking, is in mobile or online betting. Everywhere that has mobile betting, you see a rate that's close to 90% or higher.
But not every state allows mobile betting. In Maryland and North Carolina, for instance, you can bet on sports in person, but not on an app. North Carolina legislators are sharply divided over a proposal to allow online sports betting in that state. Attorney Lily Faulkner authored a Law Review article examining the legal issues involved, and she thinks the positives probably outweigh the negatives.
If you're just going to let all of that tax revenue go, that's a serious concern because you're essentially just endorsing the use of an illegal marketplace.
Bettors can find any number of unregulated offshore bookmakers that allow them to place bets on their phones, but don't generate any tax revenue.
You're just saying, well, do it under the rug instead of in a way that's going to benefit everybody here.
Except not everybody benefits.
If I could gamble on my phone, I filed bankruptcy. I don't know what kind of trouble. I would have been in much worse trouble.
Brian Hatch is in recovery from a gambling addiction. He made his last bet in 2014. Now, back then, online gambling wasn't legal where he lived.
I had to get in a car. I had to have gas money. I had to have 3-4 hours to go gamble. If I'm on my phone, I don't need that time. I can do it anytime.
Hatch says he has no doubt that legal mobile gambling has snared a lot of addicts.
I know of first responders who, while they're sitting in their cars, will gamble on their phones. I have people that I've been with in meetings and recovery who have gambled on the toilet, and it never ends. I mean, there's always sports in other countries that are happening.
And the mobile gambling industry allows bettors to lay wagers on just about anything. Patch says he checked out an app during a recent Detroit Tigers game.
You could bet on every player's at bat. You could bet whether they're going to get a hit or runs they're going to score each inning. So there's no stopping.
And that can lead to a gambler's pathology called chasing. Mark Potenza is a professor of neuroscience at Yale University's School of Medicine.
The idea of chasing, particularly with respect to gambling problems, is going back to a gambling venue to try to win back money that was recently lost. And that is certainly something that is common for people with gambling problems and often gets them into trouble.
Even the gaming industry recognizes that about 10% of gamblers get into trouble. Brian Hatch often talks about it as host of All In, the Addicted Gamblers podcast.
17% of people with a gambling addiction will attempt suicide. Up to 50% will have ideations about suicide. And then that doesn't even include people who lose their families, their friends, their jobs, their homes.
Hatch says there's really no way to protect people from becoming addicted to gambling, or to protect states from becoming addicted to gambling tax revenue. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, as Liz Truss finds her footing as the new Prime Minister of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. That's the official name, by the way. Anyway, as the Truss prime ministership gets going and she tries to figure out the energy challenge over there, the very much related inflation challenge, relations with Europe, Truss was pro-Brexit, you should know, and relations with the United States as well, do not sleep on the pound sterling.
You can get one British pound today for just about $1.15 American. The day before Brexit passed, June 22nd, 2016, the pound was at $1.47. All right, off we go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. Haven't done this in a while because air travel, as we all know, is pretty much back. So I'm just going to do this one last time. Over the Labor Day weekend, the TSA screened 8.76 million people from the 2nd to the 5th of September. Labor Day 2019, the before times, 8.62 million. So how about that? Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the executive director of that particular branch of the Marketplace Empire. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.